to the union from having been very involved in the church. I was interested in how you, when you did that and how you made that decision.
Well, I was assigned to teach at Garces High School in Bakersfield, and I was a Christian brother. I was assigned there the second time in 1962 as the senior English and religion teacher and the vice principal in charge of discipline and student activities. And I met Caesar in 1963 through the National Catholic Social Action Convention in Boston. I'd gone back there for a convention because I was very interested in social justice issues and somewhat of an activist. And back there I heard about Caesar and his organizing work in Delano. And of course it struck me as so ironic that I would go clear back to Boston to find out about someone who's living 30 miles away from me. So when I got back to Bakersfield, I called Caesar. I found him through his brother Richard. And Caesar and I became friends, and he used to come from time to time to speak to my classes or to speak to different groups that I had about his work, which at that time, of course, was very low-key organizing. And they didn't even call themselves a union. At that time, it was the National Farm Workers Association. So I was there I was there 3 years at Garces High School, and had contact time and time again with Caesar on a sort of friendly and organized basis. And then I went to USC to get my doctorate, to study for my doctorate. And that was in August of 65. And the strike broke out in October of 65. And Caesar called me and asked me if I could raise some food and money for the strike, and that things were really difficult, whatever. So I did. I raised some food and took some people up there to try to help on the picket lines a little bit, this kind of thing. And then it was just a few days afterwards, maybe a week or two, I don't know, where I just decided that if I could be of help there, I should do that. And so I left the Christian Brothers, I left TSC. And I went to work for the union. First and foremost was fundraising and up and down the state and also starting the cooperative movement and that kind of thing, which led eventually to the service center activity and founding of the service center. So that's how I got involved.
So your prior experiences had already been very interested in social justice work, so that it was a fairly natural step for you.
Yes, it was. I had become very active in the peace movement at that time, and in the civil rights movement in the South, and it was in that context that I met Marshall Gaines, who was from Bakersfield, and I met his mother. And I organized the first SNCC group. Students, Nonviolent Coordinating Activity or Committee or something like that. I organized the first SNCC group in Bakersfield to support Marshall's work in Mississippi. And we raised supplies and money, and he would come up from time to time and give speeches and all in the area, and we would sort of rally around him to help out in whatever way we could. And then that led me to working with migrant worker children. And the summer before the strike broke out, I had organized a summer program for an educational program for some 300 farm worker children. mostly blacks in the Bakersfield area, but we did have a group in the Delano area. And Bonnie was recruited, I recruited Bonnie, who was a teacher in San Francisco, to come into that program. And she was the person in charge of the Delano operation. And that's how I met Bonnie. Was in that school.
So you had come up to the Bay Area and spoken to teachers in different schools.
Yes, I put out the word through all my contacts, especially Northern California, that I was looking for master teachers. And then also I recruited high school students from around the state that came in, mostly from Northern California, that came in. And then they were supervised by these master teachers, but it was actually the high school students that actually did the tutoring, the daily tutoring. My primary purpose, it was a twofold purpose, really, was to get high school students involved. I was a high school teacher, after all, and this was a way to get high school students involved in a social justice issue, in a learning situation, and in a structured situation. And also a quote safe situation, and I had to recruit, I call them master teachers, who would come in and assist me in overseeing the work of the high school students and working with them to lay out the syllabus and the agendas and all. And we lived as a community for that summer. It was very much like a Christian summer camp, except that it had a real purpose to it, in terms of tutoring migrant worker children.
And what year would that have been?
That was the summer of, that was the summer of 85. Yeah, it had to be.
Summer of 65?
Oh, did I say 85? Yeah. No, it's of course. No, summer of 65. Gee, things happen so fast. Summer of 65, right. And then I went to graduate school in August. I started SC, and then the strike broke out. And then I started, Bonnie and I started going together in early, late 65, early 66. And then we were married in June of 66. So, one thing led to another.
And she decided to be full-time with the union at that time?
No. At what time? You mean in...
when you got married.
Yes, well, that's right. She was teaching SC. She was teaching high school in St. Paul's in San Francisco. And so we decided to get married. We decided in the springtime. And so she waited, of course, until the school year was over in June. And then we got married in June, and then I was working full-time for the union and fundraising at that point. And then our first home was Torrance. We bought, I don't know why we ever did this, we bought one of those mobile homes, except they're not so mobile, and in those days they weren't so... not so fancy like they were today, for sure. But anyway, it was our first home, and we lived in a trailer park, a mobile home park in Torrance. She and I were doing fundraising work for the farm workers, and then we got assigned to Delano. So then we brought the mobile home to Delano, and we set it up at the strike headquarters camp, which was across from the city dump. And we lived on that property until Bonnie had Claire. I guess while we had Claire, lived there, and then we finally moved into a rented house. No, I guess after we had Claire, then we moved into a rented house out in the country. But Bonnie worked full time until she had Claire. Mm-hmm. and then we had one child right after the other. So.
What were some of the aspects of the work that attracted you? Because you stayed a long time.
Yeah, I was there 8 years. I guess it was a natural outlet. I mean, it was a way. It was a very concrete way to be of help to people that needed help, and the issues were very straightforward. The rights of workers to organize and have a union, which, of course, from a Catholic Church point of view, you could hardly have a more bedrock issue than the rights of workers. And that, I mean, as slow moving or as conservative as the church is, I mean, that is one thing that ever since the late 1800s that they have championed those rights. And of course, you try to translate those rights into practical activity, and that's where all the controversy starts, even among the church people. But even so, I mean, it was an issue that, I mean, who can quarrel with it? I mean, it's so basic as far as church social teaching is concerned. And here was a very concrete way to do something that was very straightforward. I mean, the issues are very, very simple. And there was an organization that was growing and developing that a person could tie into to help, and that's very important. It's very hard to go out and do something by yourself. That's why what Caesar did was so unique. It's very hard to do something on your own steam and on your own resources, and he was able to get that started. And it's true, of course, he needed a lot of people of goodwill from all different kinds of talents and skills to help him. But still, he was a very good organizer. And working with him and the people around him gave you a lot of support. There was a lot of mutual support for the work that you were doing. And also, of course, I was traveling almost constantly at that time, up and down the state, speaking to one group after another, and raising a little bit of money here, a little bit of money there. And in that process, you just get to meet just wonderful people, just people that were just waiting to be asked to do something. And that's a very good feeling when you go into an area and no one's ever heard of the farm workers or ever heard of Caesar or whatever, and then in a few days, in a few weeks, a group comes together around the issue and is very supportive, and they begin to go taking small steps at first and then much larger steps, and it's a real satisfying thing. You might not see them again for, I don't know, 6 months, or next time you probably see them is in Delano, and it's like they're off and doing their own thing. It's not like what I'm saying is it's not the kind of thing that a person had to stay around and nurse along. It was that there was leadership, primarily out of the churches, really, church-related people, that's really all they needed was the encouragement to get started. Of course, I suppose that's a lot of what the 60s movement was all about in general. People wanted to do something.
So the fundraising you were doing, a lot of it was just meeting with groups of interested people and asking for money from donations. And
right. It was, yes. We steered away from the clothing because it was so difficult, but the food and money. Money was, I mean, the easiest thing to deal with. But food, that's how, it wasn't just me, for sure, but that is how the food caravans began to get started going down to Delano. was people like me going out and talking, and then the need for concrete action became apparent. And, well, what can we do? Well, this is what you can do. And then the idea was, well, we can take it down there, and because we had no way to get it down there, and that kind of thing. And then one thing leads to another. More and more people get involved. The more they get involved, the more they want to get involved. But also, I did some organized fundraising activity in the sense of, for specific purposes, like getting the co-op movement started, which looking back is didn't strike me as strange at the time, but it strikes me as strange now that here in the height of a strike and the rest and tension-filled activity and delaying and all that, Caesar was perfectly content to have me out talking about the co-op movement and farm workers, and we had to build that. And it shows me even to this day that from the very beginning he had far more on his mind than just winning a labor union contract. He had a more broad-based vision of what workers would need than just more money in the pockets.
I'm not familiar with the term, the co-op movement, in relationship to the union.
Well, you probably remember the gas station.
Yeah.
Well, the credit union was there. So the beginnings of the credit union were there. And that's basically a co-op movement. And then the gas station, that was the first, it was called the Farm Workers Cooperative. And the gas station and the tires and car repairs and all that, that was the first thing that got started. And I raised the money for that. I raised the money to buy the 40 acres which turned out to be the union headquarters, but also turned out to be the home for the clinic and the home for the farm workers' gas station. And I don't even know what else is on there now. Ogbeani Village is our house. But that money, I mean, I raised through individuals and groups of people and speech making and individual solicitation. It was relatively easy, to tell you the truth. I mean, at the time it seemed hard, but, I don't know. It was more logistically hard than actually hard getting people to respond. People were very, very interested.
As you think back on the years that you were with the union, what did you see the role of the farm worker ministry to be, the migrant ministry to be?
Well, being a Catholic and being a member of a religious order in the 50s and 60s, my contact with Protestant ministers was very almost non-existent. And I didn't know very much about the Christian churches at all. I mean, the ecumenical movement was not very strong in those days. So actually, the first ministers that I met were Jim Drake. Jim Drake and there was another minister I met, Phil something like. Phil lived up in out of Portville. Jim was more active in the strike and picket lines and stuff like that than I was in the beginning, but then there was more in the organizing farm worker activities. But that's how I met them. I mean, they were like I was in a way. I mean, they were church-related, church-associated, and I wasn't that direct at that time, in the sense because I had left the Christian Brotherhood. I mean, I was still a Catholic, but I was in a religious order, and I wasn't there representing the church officially in any way. And but they seem to be. I mean, they seem to have a certain church status there.
Jim Sellery was paid by the United Church of Christ for years by the conference.
Right. I came to know that. I mean, you know, at first, of course, I didn't know, but yes, I knew that they were part. That's how I heard of the farm worker ministry. Where I got to know the ministry the best, really, was, and I guess firsthand, was when I was in Los Angeles on the Prop 22 campaign and also the Safeway boycott campaign, and there was another, and the DiGiorgio boycott. Then I worked with Chris. When I say I worked with, I mean, I had office space in his offices. And he and I became very, very close friends. And he became, he taught me a lot, and we worked together very well, complemented each other in a lot of different ways, on different kinds of farm worker activities, but of a support nature, in other words, of a boycott or that kind of thing in the Los Angeles area. And I don't know. I just accepted the farm worker ministry involvement as just a sort of integral part of the program. You know, I mean, I didn't know too much about it really, but one of the things that struck me is about that program was how they were able to be separate and yet be so helpful and an integral part of the program. In other words, I know from experience how difficult it is for outside groups to come in and help as an outside group, to come in and help, have their own agenda, which they must have, and yet not screw up the agenda of the group that they're working with and for. And over the years, I was always amazed how the ministry was able to do that, and I'm not sure how they were able to do that. I pretty much attributed it to Chris in terms of his leadership and know-how, but I don't really know. I suppose a lot of it is the type of people that were attracted in the first place, and their priorities and their personalities. But I think they gave a strength to the union that the union otherwise would not have had. And it was also a strength, it was also a tempering. I mean, it was an outside group with its own base and its own ties. They were, but yet, part of the movement. And so, therefore, they had a very subtle and invisible, if you will, political role to play, in the sense of not allowing, the union could not allow to alienate such helpful people. And one of the ways they could have alienated these people, I presume, is if they had gone in for a violent activity or gone off on some type of ideological tangent. That would have made this support group very uncomfortable, and I suppose would have driven them off. And so it was a tempering thing, which I think was very good for the union at that time.
Do you think the union would have been inclined to go off in either of those directions?
Yes. Inevitably, I think it would have been inclined to. I don't see how they could avoid it, because I mean, after all, the union is composed of just human beings. And traditionally, the violence has been an integral part of strike activity in the United States. regardless of race, color, creed, or national origin. And I mean, there were traditional labor leaders who were absolutely frustrated with Caesar's unwillingness to, quote, get in and get the job done. In other words, you know, take a more violent posture or respond in kind or you know, be somewhat destructive. But that was just not, first of all, I don't think Caesar personally, I don't think it was a viable option for him personally. And I don't think he believed it. But he could not I don't think he could have stood against that by himself. Just as one leader, I think he could have been brushed aside. But he had allies on this issue that were part and parcel of the Union movement. So it was very hard to, he could outflank these attacks rather easily if he wanted to, and he did want to. In terms of ideological tangents, this happens to movement after movement. I mean, you know, the civil rights movement started off, basic issues, very, and then pretty soon, was it too long? We're talking about black power and black separatists and fighting the war, which are all worthy issues. It's just that you can't do everything at once. And one of the strengths of Caesar and the Union was having a single issue and not deviating from that. And Caesar would not be drawn into, while he had his own thoughts and ideas about all these other things, he did not get sidetracked. See, because if he'd gone off on all different kinds, let's take, I even forget what the issues of the day were. I'm going to use a couple because I don't think they were the issues of the day. But suppose he would have gone off on the issues of, of abortion, of Vietnam, the civil rights movement at that time, Martin Luther King was very prominent. I mean, if he would have gone off into all those things, it would have split the people that were around him, because those people all had different ideas, I'm sure, about those very same things. And but yet on one issue, namely the rights of workers to organize, and that that's a basic right, I mean, that was something that everyone could agree on. And so that's, you got to sort of keep your priorities straight. And Caesar always used to have a saying, you have to keep your eye on the target. That was it.
What do you think of, what did you see Caesar's own personal qualities to be that seem to have been so effective in attracting support from the churches?
Well, his obvious dedication in his lifestyle. He was a family man. He lived in voluntary poverty. His personality was very low-key, very sincere. He took time with people, which I didn't realize at the time how valuable that was, but as you grow older and you get more involved, you understand the value of time. But he gave individual time to people, and in a way, he was organizing them by doing that. On some people, it was it helped to attract some people, and it didn't attract other people. Not that it repelled them, but I'm saying is that, you know, you don't know when you sit down with a person or when you take time with a person whether you're going to be successful in turning that person on to your cause, and that the person will give you that much help in the long run. It's like you're making an investment and you're hoping it will pay off. And he did that time and time and time and time again, and in some cases it paid off, in other cases, not that it hurt necessarily, but it didn't pay off very much. I think that there was a religious component to the movement. I don't think it was necessarily Catholic, though I think most people recognize that the farmer groups, especially the Hispanics, were at least culturally Catholic. But that it was more than just a labor union contract issue. I mean, there was more, it had other dimensions to the movement than that, namely the quality of people's lives and helping people to better their lot in life, but at the same time not just to make more money, but also for them to make a contribution to other people. And that was always implicit. And Caesar spent a lot of time on this example, the health clinics. We've always had a health clinic from almost day one. In other words, they were also a way to organize, but there was also more than that to it. I mean, there was sort of a broad-based way to deal with people in the different aspects of their lives. Also, the fact is that religion. Religious service, if you will, played an integral role in the union meetings, in the union celebrations, in the union parties, in the union marches, in the union. I mean, I think this was also a way for Caesar to stress the nonviolent aspect of the movement. I think that's true, but it's also something that I think he believed in. But see, once again, it was like religion. And religious life is an integral part of a person's life, and it cannot be separated and should not be separated just because it's about unions or management or collective bargaining. I hadn't thought about this, but I think at the time, also, is that the churches were very involved in the civil rights movement in the South, at least in support ways. And the whole Black Power and separatist movement, I think, was very startling to church people that were involved and gave them very serious misgivings about what role they should or should not play or could not play. And I think when they bumped into the farm workers movement, I think they were tremendously relieved that there wasn't that aspect of it, and they were accepted as people that wanted to help, and whether they were white or whether they were middle class or whether they were very wealthy or whether they had no money, it did not make any difference. I mean, if they had something to contribute, and even if it was just nothing but their time, they were welcome. So maybe what the civil rights movement lost in terms of church support, maybe some of that found a home in the farm workers movement. I'm not sure.
Later in the movement, and I don't know if it had begun yet, toward the end of your time on staff, but you certainly have stayed in touch and you would have some observations about it. Some people began, in the churches, began to be uncomfortable. For instance, that the union had money to spend on political campaigns. And they saw these changes in the union and they were uncomfortable with them. I wonder if you might have any observations about that.
Well, the problem is that they're observations from afar. I mean, I don't think there was any uncomfortableness that I can really... I left in August of 73. And I know that the union was not spending any money on political campaigns except Prop 22, which they raised money to spend on to fight the proposition. I don't know. I don't know how to. I'm not sure how to. What my own feelings about that are, because for so many years I had the opportunity to observe these things from the inside and think about some of the ramifications. But when you're looking at something from the outside, it's very hard to. When I knew all the ins and outs that went on about certain things, I mean, as I sit here and trying to look back from the outside about things that happened after I left, I'm very tentative because there's so many, on the face of it, something seems to me, gee, well, how could that possibly happen? And on the other hand, you know, I don't know all the ramifications of it. But I would say that I'm afraid it's inevitable in any organization that as it grows and has its own base and has its own board of directors and has its own membership that it has to be responsive to, that it's inevitable, it seems to me, that support people are going to be more and more on the sidelines. And honestly, I think they should be. And it's sort of one of the reasons why I left. While it turned out to be a propitious time, it was sort of accidental too. But I think that volunteers that stayed, they were volunteers, and in the sense that they were outsiders who became intricately involved in the movement and who became Caesar's closest advisors and friends and all that, which I have nothing wrong with. But when that person, I think that person makes a serious mistake in judgment, then to join, to become a member of the executive board of the union, because I don't think that's their role. And if they do make that decision, then what they're doing is they're stepping out of their support role and they're doing something else, which is, I'm sure, legitimate. But on the other hand, then they cannot have it both ways. And I think that as this organization grows and make their own decisions and raise money and make money, if you will, from dues and health plan contributions and pension plans and all that stuff, there's no way around it. I mean, they're going to have to decide what's best for themselves. If that offends people, support people, volunteer people, it's unfortunate, but I'm afraid it's sort of unrealistic on the part of the outsider. The other thing is that happens, I'm sure it happens, is that, and it happened in this case, is that it's impossible for the union, as a union, not to become involved in other kinds of issues. And once you start becoming involved in other kinds of issues, I would predict that it begins to turn off certain kinds of people. And it has. I mean, I'm trying to think of an example. I wasn't there, but there was a lot of publicity anyway about, I think Caesar went to the Philippines and met with Marcos or something like that. Well, I don't know what really the politics of that whole situation are. I don't know why he did it, but I know that it caused a good deal of stir among people that couldn't imagine how Caesar could go meet with a dictator or something like that. See, that's what I'm saying is that, those are growth pains, it seems to me. And of course, I don't see anything wrong with if a person is supporting a group and contributing money and time and effort and has, and then that movement takes a turn that the person really can't agree with. There's nothing wrong with saying, I've gone as far as I can go. But see, people won't do that. I mean, what they want to do is they want to hang on. They want to say, they don't want to say, I've gone as far as I can go. They want to say, Caesar can't do that. He's got to do this. And then they begin organizing, if you will, or working behind the scenes to get Caesar to change his mind about something or to get the executive board to begin the politic. And then they start playing union politics. And then what happens is the union starts playing union politics back, and then they get stung and hurt, and then they can't imagine what happened. Why are they persona non grata all of a sudden? It's easy for me to talk like this. It's very hard when personal feelings and years of support are involved to be so calm, cool, and collected when an issue like this comes up. This is my own personal opinion. I mean, I like Marshall very much. I'm the one that recruited Marshall to come in and work for the union. I just don't feel very sorry for Marshall and what happened to him. I feel very upset to this day. There's nothing I can do about it now, nothing I can do about it then. But I feel it was very unfortunate the way that Jack Quigley was treated and was pressured to leave the union. I mean, that type of activity I feel is wrong, I feel it's unwarranted, and I feel that it's a weakness that Caesar and some of the other leadership have from time to time about certain people, for which I don't know why, but I don't think it's right. But to me, that's different than a person like Marshall, for example, who wants to become a voting member of the union, and I think he steps outside of his role into some other brand new role, and it's a different ball.
I didn't know the story with Jack Quigley.
Well, I don't know the story myself. Is that and part of it is it's so personal with me because Jack and I were such close friends, and I think he made such a contribution to the union in his day-to-day work as serving as controller for the union and doing the painstaking work that, I mean, I only know too well how difficult it is and how much long-suffering you have to do it. And, of course, he was tremendously physically handicapped, if you will, being in a wheelchair and being paralyzed. And he was of such goodwill and such big heart, and then he must have had a run-in with Caesar and others, some of the other board members about, I don't know, the way certain things were handled, I don't know. But instead of graciously winding it down or graciously handling the situation, it's abrupt and cruel and somewhat mean and I don't know. I've seen it happen several times to different people that I've been closely associated with, and it's on different issues and different levels. I'm not necessarily talking about these kind of high-ranking policy decisions in Japan. It's just a way of dealing with people that have been so helpful and have given so much, and when it comes time for them to go and they don't know it, maybe there's a way to must be a way to handle that in a more Christian fashion. And some of those issues, some of those kinds of issues have bothered me and still bother me.
Do you think that there's any realistic possibility of the UFW continuing to function as this community without salaries?
I don't know. I don't know. I think you said without salaries. I think not, but I'm not. Times change, movements change, people change. Because something worked for 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, and it was needed, doesn't mean that it has to be that way. I say to myself, I think there could be another way to handle it. I think the salaries could be modest. Could be adequate, modest. I think there's a lot to be said for salaries in and of themselves, in terms of making people more responsible, making people more feeling better about themselves, helping people to feel more independent about themselves. What they're doing is willing, as opposed to that they have no choice, or little choice. I'm very hesitant about it, only because I'm not involved, and I don't like to, and I don't think much about telling people how to run their own business or their own programs, or if my opinion is asked or something, I have opinions, but it's just that I don't, once again, see, I don't know all the, I mean, I know what Caesar's feelings are about it. He's always been opposed to it. I presume he'll always be opposed to it. I don't agree with that, but so. See, I don't think it's any big deal. And it should not be a big deal that if a person doesn't agree with it or can't, if those are the rules, and a person says, it's fine, nothing, I just can't live by those rules, I don't want to live by those rules, fine. I mean, what's the big problem? I mean, but see, what happens is that people get so, it's natural, they get so emotionally, philosophically, spiritually, I guess, everything, wound up in their way of life also, that they don't even recognize when it's time to move on. It's hard to move on. It's hard to make another. If you've given so much of yourself and of your time, you want to hang on. The tendency is to hang on. Mm-hmm. I think that's sad. I mean, it's sad because if people are unhappy hanging on. Both sides are unhappy. What I would have preferred was if I'd ever been involved, maybe I would have had some influence about this. But when you leave, you leave. For example, I'll use myself as an example because my leaving was very non-bitter in any way. I mean, it was sad. It was sad for Caesar. It was sad for us. It had nothing to do with the union. It had to do with us personally. But when we left, we had nothing. Well, we were able to adjust and to get jobs and to, you know. And it can be argued that our experience there and the work that we did there helped us to open up doors to job opportunities that otherwise we would not have had. An argument can be made, and there's some certain sense of truth in it. But what I'm going to say now is I'm not saying this to that I look back and said, oh, what a shame that this didn't happen. I'm just saying that had there been some type of help, financially perhaps, some bridge, some transitional bridge to help us move and relocate and help us to get established a little bit, that would have ingrained feelings in us that would have lasted, that we would have been grateful for the rest of our lives. Now, not having that doesn't mean, well, we're ungrateful. It wasn't expected. But there was no money, really. It wasn't expected. You can't, how can you do it for one and not do it for others? I mean, those are all those practical kinds of problems. But I'm saying that, if, you know, had there been some type of understanding, sensitivity to people who had to leave, and you would help them to make that transition, a lot of the, maybe some of the misunderstandings and the bitterness and some of the shameful feelings, I guess, of having had to leave the union or being forced out of the union, I would have been dissipated. You know, that, after the fact, thinking. But the idea of, like, the person leaves and they're cut off kind of thing, it's unnecessary. That's the way religious orders used to operate.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. And you walk out the door, bang, it's, you know, shut the door quietly.
They've learned.
Oh, yeah. It's a big change. Sure. But you have to, yeah, look, I'm sure, see, I'm not close enough to the union. I'm sure the union has done that time and time again that I'm not, that I have no way of being aware of. It's helping people to make the transition back to things that they have, that they want to do or have to do, or when it comes time for them to leave. I'm sure that that has happened. But in those days, the resources were such that it was very difficult.
Well, this has been really helpful, Leroy. I appreciate your taking the time to do this. Would there be anything else that you especially want me to know?
Well, I'll be very surprised if your book will not be forced to point out how valuable the union, in this case, the union movement, the farm workers movement, was for the churches themselves, and how much that it helped them to raise their level of consciousness about other people and poor people and people who were in struggle. And I often think that that type of early activity, you know, involving churches and church people being involved and raising the level of consciousness could not, must have helped in some of the attitudes that we now see in the churches, especially about Central and South America, in third world countries, and the whole question of nuclear arms and all. I think they're all interrelated, and I somehow believe that that indirectly, the union, the Farmworkers Movement, has probably helped the churches to come to grips with these kinds of issues. I can't prove that, but I really believe that. Okay.